Okay, so now we switch over to talk about what Jewish sages have said. In source number 6 on the sheet, and again, for those who were the early birds on the source sheet, and therefore you didn't have the Jeremiah source, so you're looking at source number 5. I brought you from Lucretius, who was a Roman writer in the first century before the Common Era. He's a poet. And he says that, of course, there are extraterrestrial beings. He says there have to be extraterrestrial beings. He says, besides, when matter abundant is ready there, when space on hand nor object nor any cause retards, no marvel tis that things are carried on and made complete perforce. He says, if nothing is stopping it, then of course, if you have the materials, life is going to exist. And now if store of seeds there is so great that not whole lifetimes of the living can count the tale, and if their force and nature abide the same, able to throw the seeds of things together into their places, even as here are thrown the seeds together in this world of ours, it must be confessed in other realms there are still other worlds, still other breeds of men, and other generations of the wild. He says, of course there are animals, and of course there are people, because you have ingredients for life, you have space, you have nothing preventing it, so of course there will be life. That's the way that it's. That's the way that he reads it. I've seen a quote, but I haven't found where the original text is, so I didn't bring it, from a 13th century Chinese political philosopher, Teng Mu, who says it's unreasonable to think that there is nothing besides us. So you have others in other societies weighing in on this. What did our sages believe? So, Midrashim seem to build off verses in Tanakh to support intelligent life elsewhere. Now, I want to be careful with how I say this, because I have to make sure this is clear. I am not saying that the biblical text they quote says E.T. is out there, is on Mars, is on some moon of Jupiter or wherever else. That's not what I'm saying. But our sages envisioned life elsewhere, intelligent life elsewhere, as being entirely possible, such that it influenced the way that they analyzed and explained biblical verses. So I'll give you examples. Take a look at source number 7. The last volume of Mishnah in the Talmud is called Uktzin. It deals with very esoteric areas of Jewish law. It deals with purity and impurity of produce and how it is communicated. And then you get to the very end. And the last text, it's not actually a Mishnah. It was added to Uktzin, giving all of Mishnah a nice ending. But it's not actually part of Mishnah, because the sage who speaks there is Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi, who was a generation after the Mishnah. So it was added to it. It's a better ending for the Talmud than a discussion about stems of fruits and whether they are part of the fruit for purposes of purity and impurity. So this is what he says. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi said, God will give each righteous person 310 worlds. Where in the world does that come from, 310 worlds? He quotes you a verse in Proverbs chapter 8, where God says he is going to give those who love God yesh, and I will fill their treasure houses. Yesh means substance. But the sages looked at that and said the numerical value of the letters in the word yesh, yud, shin, right? Those who were here last year when we did the numerology class on gematria. So yud is 10. Shin is 300. That's 310. There's a promise of 310 worlds. Now, you could tell me that can't be meant literally. What in the world would I do with 310 worlds? And the answer is you have eternity on your hands. You could probably do a lot with 310 worlds. But maybe you'd even want 311. This is a passage that gets quoted as evidence that they believed it's entirely possible for there to be other worlds. Another passage like this is source number 8, found in the Zohar, building off of a verse in Song of Songs. And it says, "And those who provide merit for the masses, people who enable mitzvot for others," it's called in Hebrew, matzdikei harabim, "those who enable others to be righteous, will be like stars forever, like stars certainly that are innumerable, for each and every star is called a world of its own." And then it references the verse in Song of Songs that talks about King Solomon having alamot without number. So alamot literally means maidens, M-A-I-D-E-N-S, maidens. However, the Zohar says no, not maidens, but olamot, worlds, worlds without number. Because those righteous people are like stars, each one has his own star, therefore the early ones established each righteous person has his own world. Again, the idea that there are worlds elsewhere. Now, that speaks of habitable worlds. That doesn't mean that they are inhabited. It just says that that the sages think that there are habitable worlds. And again, whether the verse in Song of Songs, whether the verse in Proverbs is actually meant literally to be read that way isn't my focus. My point is that the rabbis in commenting on it are fully comfortable with the idea that there are habitable worlds out there. But source number 9 will be more clear. For anyone who is reading sources 7 and 8 and thinking, I don't understand, what happened? What is Yesh and how does it deal with the reward of the righteous and maidens and worlds in number 8? Look at number 9. Number 9 will be easier. The number 9 is much more straightforward. This is a midrash, Bereshit Rabbah. They quote a verse from Ecclesiastes that says that God made everything in its proper time, as hakol asa yafeh bi'ito. Rabbi Avahu said, we see from here that God created worlds and destroyed them. Created worlds and destroyed them. Until he created these, meaning our world, and said, this is good for me. Those were not good for me. It's saying explicitly that God has created multiple iterations of the world before getting to ours. And Rabbi Pinchas said, Rabbi Avo based himself on the following verse. In creation it says, and God saw all that he had created and it was very good. When you say this is very good, it's because something else wasn't. This is good for me, those were not good for me. So this is a midrash which clearly states that there have been other worlds. This is about the past, not necessarily about being contemporary with us. But that there were worlds that God created, and then he started again. When I was in grade 7 or grade 8, they came to my school and they showed us a movie. I don't know who they were. I just say they. But they showed us a movie about how science had, at that stage, which is a long time ago, science may have changed since then. This was 1985 or 1986. But they said that there have been 4 magnetic North Poles, and there have been 4 ice ages, and so on. And they drew on this passage and similar passages that seem to indicate that we are in the 5th world, the 4th world, the 5th world, whatever it is. Oh boy, there's going to be a massive parade right outside the room that I'm in. We're just going to have to pause. For those who are not aware, today is Rosh Chodesh Adar. It's the first day of the month of Adar, and the month of Adar is a month of joy and celebration, and high school students rampaging around the halls. Yeah, I don't know if you can hear. So, this is good. This is better than other things. Okay. This parade may end up coming back our way. We'll have to see. Anyway, this passage gets quoted to argue that you can fit ideas like dinosaurs, ideas like fossils and all of that into Judaism, suggesting, look, there were worlds and then there were extinctions, and then there were worlds and there were extinctions, and so on. Okay. So, that's about past inhabited worlds. What about current inhabited worlds? Two passages in the Talmud. The number 10 is talking about what God does. What does God spend all day or all night doing? When God is not, looking out for us, I guess. Or, is running us on autopilot or whatever it is that God is doing. I'm joking, obviously. God doesn't need autopilot. But this is based on a verse in Psalms chapter 68. And it says, God rides a swift cherub, kruvim, type of angel, and travels among 18,000 worlds. God is taking a tour of 18,000 worlds, which suggests there's something going on there, that there's something there for God to visit. God is moonlighting, so to speak. Space lighting, I don't know. Going off into other realms. And then you get a very interesting passage in source number 11. Some of you, I think, may have even been with me when we learned the book of Shoftim, the book of Judges, in the Thursday afternoon class. It was a long time ago when we did chapter 5. It would have been about 10 years ago. But there's a story in chapter 4, chapter 5 of Judges, in which the Jews are living under the control of Canaanites. This is talking about a period that's about, I think, 100, 120 years after the Jews enter Israel under Joshua. And the Jews revolt against the Canaanites. They're led by a woman named Deborah, and a general named Barak. And there's a woman named Yael who kills the opposing general, Sisera. And after the battle is won, Deborah composes a poem about the victory. And in this poem, the Song of Deborah, she talks about who volunteered to fight and who chose to sit out the fight. Anyone, are you familiar with the story? Does it ring a bell? So in this story, she talks about something called Meroz. If you take a look at source number 11, I first brought you in italics the verse from Judges. She says, "Cursed be Meroz," says the Malach, the angel of God. "Cursed be its residents, for they did not come to the aid of God." So the simple read of what this is that there was either a great person named Meroz who didn't help the Jews in their revolt against Canaan, or there was a village named Meroz. Right? That's the way I would have read this if I hadn't read the passage in the Talmud in source number 11. Some say this is a powerful person named Meroz, and some say it is a star, because there's another passage in her song in which she talks about the stars waging war on our behalf against Canaan. So what you have here is residents of people living on some foreign star, some foreign body that's out there in space, and they were supposed to help us. So, again, what this means, like, why is the Talmud reading that in, that there are inhabitants of stars out there, is a really good question. But my point is simply to say that you have sources that show the rabbis are very comfortable with the idea of there being, number one, we said habitable worlds, the worlds that are promised to the righteous, past inhabited worlds that were created and destroyed, although maybe that's here on earth, maybe it's not, and currently inhabited worlds that God visits, this thing called Meroz. They were very comfortable. Now, you could resolve some of these sources, and we will see, either today or next week, that some do say that these are all meant to be not physical worlds, but something spiritual. They're not meant to be something physical. It works for some of these. It doesn't work for all of them. It doesn't work for source number 9, the worlds that God created and destroyed, as an example. But it may work for some of these. Clear? Somewhat? Okay, comments? Wow, it's so quiet when the parade goes away. Okay. So, I want to move to the next phase, which is medieval times, late medieval period, and what the rabbis did when they dealt with this question head on. In 14th century Spain, there was a rabbi named Rabbi Chasdai Kreshkesh. Some of you may remember, we had a series last year, the Los Pensadores, right? The philosophers of medieval Spain. So one of the philosophers we mentioned was Rabbeinu Nissim. He was the political philosopher. Talked about checks and balances in government. So Rabbi Chasdai Kreshkesh was a student of Rabbeinu Nissim. He was very wealthy, but he suffered persecution for being Jewish. One of his sons was murdered for being a Jew. He's known primarily for his philosophical works, which are the ones that remain. And he writes a book called Or Hashem, The Light of God, in which he doesn't seem concerned at all about anthropocentricity. Are we the purpose or not? And he deals with this question of, so is there life out there, intelligent life out there, or not? Take a look at source number 12. I brought you first from him, arguments in favor of life elsewhere. And he says, among these arguments for life existing elsewhere, is however the world was created, whether by desire, because God wanted it, or requirement, because it had to be. Why couldn't the desire or requirement include another world or worlds beyond this one? If God wanted to create us, maybe God wanted to create more. Simple, straightforward, logical. Among them, another argument. According to our explanation that the world was created at divine desire, to provide good and favor, right? That's what we believe. Not that the world had to exist, but God chose to create it. It is clear that the desire to provide good has no stinginess, and adding worlds would add to the provision of goodness. It is possible, then, that there could be many worlds. He says, taking it as a given that God creates the universe in order to benefit his creations. The reason why we exist is because God wants to provide good, so let's provide more good. Create more people, create more beings, and let more benefit. Why should there be any maximum? Now, you could argue that, you know, maybe when you create more of us, it creates more strife. But that's his argument. He says, the more you create, the more benefit there is, so God should be creating more. On the other hand, he says, maybe not. First of all, he makes a physics argument. He says, among them, among the negatives, among the reasons not to say it, if multiple worlds coexisted, these worlds would be separated, and the space between them would be either empty or substantive, right? If there's a world out there with other living beings, the space between that world and us is either empty, or there's some kind of material separating between us and them. Early philosophers argue that a vacuum is impossible. And so there must be matter, transparent or not, between these worlds, right? Maybe it's plexiglass. If this were transparent, we would see multiple suns and moons at times when they were above the horizon. If this were substantive, then since some non-illuminating celestial bodies reflect light from elsewhere, like the moon which receives light from the sun, and like some stars according to one view, then the matter between the worlds should also receive light from the suns, and we should see many stars from another world or worlds. Our senses mandate that we say there is only one world. He says, if there are other worlds out there, why don't we see them? That's essentially his argument. Either because there should be, you know, visible across space, or because we should see whatever it is that's dividing between us and them. He's writing this in 14th century Spain. You know, give him time for physics to catch up and we'll understand why you can't see those things. And we can see planets, right? We have wonderful telescopes that, you know, the Webb Space Telescope, we can see an awful lot that's out there. He would be amazed. But that's one argument. On the philosophical level, he says, I'll tell you why you could argue that there aren't, that God would not create anything out there. He says, among them, multiplicity exists only in entities which are vulnerable to deterioration, like animals and plants. This indicates that multiplicity is only to preserve species, which is why non-deteriorating entities do not have multiplicity. He says, things that deteriorate need to have, you need to have more of them. Things that do not deteriorate, you only have one of them. That's the argument. So he says, I see your note in the chat, Dr. Kirshen. I'm going to come back to that point, I hope today, because it is something I'm going to be addressing. But he says in source number 13, he says, since this world cannot deteriorate, that's his assumption, this mandates that there be no multiplicity. God doesn't need to create multiple worlds because this one is doing just fine. We don't need preserving. Man, if he were alive today. That's his second argument that he brings here. And then third, he says, among them, among the arguments against, the creator of all existence is one. God is one in the purest sense. And so it will be suitable for that which exists to be one. This is because of the accepted point that a pure one should only create a pure one. It's accepted philosophically. He's making a philosophical argument. It is also because the great perfection of something which exists and is influenced is to resemble that which influences to the extent possible. Whatever God created should reflect God. Now, Rabbi Kreshkes is not sold on any of these arguments. So I know you're probably not sold on a lot of them either. Neither is he. Take a look at number 14. He says, regarding the first positive argument, right? The argument where he said, what was the first positive one? Why couldn't God desire to create more than one world? He says, this doesn't require another world's existence. It only argues for the possibility. God could. Similarly, the second positive argument that says God wants to benefit everybody, so let him benefit more, he says the worlds could not be finite if you're going to make that argument. For adding to any number of worlds would increase the benefit, right? You would then have to have more worlds and more worlds and more worlds. The world cannot be infinite, for that would require infinite coexisting matter. That can't be. Since we cannot require finite and infinite substance, it becomes clear that multiplicity cannot be required. He says it doesn't make any sense. If you're going to make the argument that once God is creating benefit, God should create more things to benefit, then either that mandates that God just creates an infinite number of things to benefit, which he says that can't happen physically, or it means that God is not going to create an infinite one, but then why is he going to stop wherever he stops? So therefore, he says, that argument is not a sustainable argument. On the other hand, he doesn't like the arguments against either. Regarding the first negative argument, hey, why can't I see those other worlds? He said, perhaps it's due to the great distance between worlds, that the stars are not visible to us. They're too far away. We can't see them. That's why. And as far as the second argument, which was you only need multiplicity in order to preserve species, he says logical comparisons are not proof. You can't make comparisons like that about why this exists in multiples and this does not. Further multiplication of immortal entities in one world might be unnecessary or even harmful, but that doesn't constitute proof regarding their presence in multiple worlds. Maybe there could be multiplicity of things that are immortal. And then regarding the third argument against, the idea that if God is one, he should have created only one thing, he says, why? The multiplicity that exists in multiple worlds does not harm the unity present in a single world. He says, I don't see it. And so he says, since it's true that none of the reasons we presented, positive or negative, are sufficient grounds to determine the truth, and what they provide is only the possibility of multiplicity, it is appropriate that we not distance the lesson of some of our sages, the one that we saw back in source number 10. This teaches that he travels among 18,000 worlds, meaning his supervision travels among those worlds. So Rabbi Kreshkes says, I see arguments for, I see arguments against. The arguments aren't convincing on one side. The arguments are not convincing on the other side. But I know that the sages in the Talmud describe God visiting all these other worlds. So as far as I'm concerned, that means there are other worlds. That's his take on it. Clear? Comments? Or can we, should we go further? Yes, Etty.
How did they arrive to 18,000 worlds?
So it's a gematria, it's not really a gematria, I shouldn't call it a gematria. I didn't want to go into it because it's just going to confuse things even further, but which is hard. But if you take a look at Psalms chapter 68, sentence 18, it talks about Rechev Ribotayim Alfei Sha'anan, Sha'anan, and it's based on Ribotayim, right? You know that Ribo is 10,000. Yes, Ribo is 10,000. Ribotayim would be 20,000 minus Alfei. Alfei is 2,000. The minimum plural is 2. So it's 20,000 minus 2,000 leaves you with 18,000. If that helps you, great. But I hope you understand why I didn't bring it. Okay. So the Rabbi Kreshkish in the 14th century is very comfortable with this idea that there are other worlds. He's debating. He says this way. He says that way. He says, I don't know. Could be. And I've got a passage in the Talmud that talks about God supervising these other worlds. Now, he had a student, Rabbi Yosef Albo, who we've talked about also. I think we may have even done it in the Pensadores class. He wrote a book called Sefer HaIkarim. And it is claimed, Rabbi Pinchas Horowitz, a later writer we're about to see, claims that Rabbi Albo disagreed with Rabbi Kreshkish on this. However, I looked in Rabbi Albo's writings and I could not find anywhere where he disagreed with Rabbi Kreshkish. I can't find it anywhere, so I don't know. But this Rabbi Pinchas Horowitz was very, very interesting. Rabbi Pinchas Horowitz of Vilna, and we'll start on this, but I see we have 5 minutes left, so we're going to have to continue with him next week. He was a Kabbalist and a lover of science. He lived in Vilna, as you see here, in the 18th century. And he wrote a book called Sefer HaBrit, Book of the Covenant, in which he tries to present the science of his day, up to the minute, science of his time, recognizing God as the creator of all of it. But he's trying to teach you science from a perspective of Torah in the 18th century. The book is available online on HebrewBooks.org, Sefer HaBrit. It's a very interesting book. His belief is that there are other worlds. They could be inhabited by people who are intelligent, but they don't have free will. That's where he draws the line. He says, no bechira chofshit, no free will for the inhabitants of those worlds. We have to talk about that, obviously. He was very upset about, and this is probably what triggered him to write it, the work of a man named Johann Hevelius, H-E-V-E-L-I-U-S. Hevelius was the mayor of Danzig in the 17th century, and he was also an astronomer. And he claimed, making his observations of other worlds, he claimed that he saw geographical features that were hills and rivers, like the way people look up at Mars or at the moon and they think they see things, and, you know, the moon is made of green cheese and there's a man in the moon and all of these things. And this is something people have believed for a long time, that you could find features like those on Earth on other planets. So this fellow Hevelius describes habitable worlds much like ours. Rabbi Pinchas Horowitz was not a fan of that idea. He agrees that there could be life there, but he says he's not into these observations. Take a look at source number 15. He says, and Dr. Kirshen, you'll have to wait with the question of Bereshit until next time, because that's where it's going to come in. But he says, there is among the emptinesses of the nations, meaning their vanities, the things they say that are empty, those who make the stars material. They think that the stars are not just energy, but they are material. And they are great and mighty in philosophy, saying that all the stars, those that are fixed, those that move, are actual material worlds with people and many animals. And some of them say that the stars which do not illuminate, stars which do not illuminate means planets. That's what he's talking about, or maybe asteroids, but bodies out there that are not stars, are lands and worlds. And those that illuminate are suns for those worlds. And the nations also say that the marks seen on celestial bodies via looking implements called Fahrenglaser, right? Fahren, distant, glaser, glasses. Dark marks and light marks, some of the spheres being black, some of them being white, are mountains and hills and seas. So he says, without a doubt, he, God, did not create it for nothing. He created it to be settled, which is based on a verse in Isaiah. And there are creatures, but not because of their reason, the parable of the great field. He says, I believe that there is life out there, but not for the reason that everybody else is saying. They said, how could so many in such large stars not have a population? While the small earth is settled, he says, their argument is, of course there's life out there. The world is so big. We have life. Why wouldn't they? To which he says, to this I would respond that all of them were created only for the benefit of this world. The argument of anthropocentricity. And so he says, I think there is life out there, but I don't think it's because of, well, they've got so much space, therefore there's probably life out there. He brings other reasons, which we have to see, for why he believes in life on other planets, even intelligent life, but it's 11 o'clock, so we're going to have to pick up with that, God willing, next time. Thank you very much, everyone. I'll take questions and comments next time, I think, because I got to actually run. So we'll start with Q&A from that, and then we'll pick up from there. Chodesh Tov, have a wonderful month of Adar. You can also do a parade.